Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware is in the process of creating a new Department of Veterans Affairs with a cabinet-level secretary.
The first priority is to go out and feel where the veterans feel left out, because if people aren't coming into us, it's because they don't feel like they're heard.
This week we sit down with the secretary of the new Veterans Affairs Department, retired Brigadier General Karen Berry. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn what a new survey of first aid educators tells us about how satisfied Delaware teachers are. And Arts Playlist previews the Delaware Art Museum's latest exhibition on the art of illustration. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first aid of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Veterans Day is this Tuesday, and this year, Delaware can point to an increased commitment to the 72,000 vets living in the first state. Earlier this year, state lawmakers passed, and Governor Matt Meyer signed, legislation creating Delaware's first state-level Department of Veterans Affairs with a cabinet-level secretary. Meyer then selected retired Brigadier General Karen Berry to serve as the first Veterans Affairs secretary. She stepped into that role October 1st. Brigadier General Berry retired from the Delaware National Guard in 2023 following more than 3 decades of service. She was the first female in the Delaware National Guard to hold a brigade command position and earn the rank of Brigadier General. Since retiring from the Guard, she served as a veterans advocacy specialist at Delaware Tech's Owens campus. This week, retired Brigadier General Karen Berry joined me to discuss the new Department of Veterans Affairs and how she plans to build it. When Governor Meyer and his team approached you about becoming the first secretary of this new department, what was your initial reaction? Was it unexpected?
It was. I actually got a phone call the day that he signed the bill, the afternoon of. And so, yes, I was not expecting it. And I'm leaving retirement. My husband is newly retired, and we had all these big plans, and I just figured, you know what, God has a different plan for me.
Was there any, I don't want to say trepidation, but, you know, uncertainty if you wanted to leave retirement to do this, or did you figure this is an opportunity you couldn't pass up?
I think because I know it's needed.
Mm-hmm.
I know I can do good, you know, I'm hoping that I can do good for and be a help so that veterans in Delaware get some focus, get educated, and have availability of resources. And it helps that you're brand new in a position because you get to create it. So mm-hmm. I don't have the stress of trying to fill in someone else's shoes. I'm creating the job. And so I feel like there's flexibility in that. And I was looking forward to being retired and traveling at will. But there's time for that. And I just figured God has a plan, and I just have to go with it.
With that in mind, I mean, do you see this as more of a challenge, building it from the ground up, as you mentioned, or as an opportunity to do something new and better?
I think it's both. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge because I will have and have in the first month had people reach out to me and my team. And what's funny, you know, I do have a team, but the team that's in place has a big job, and we're not staffed at the level we need to for them to do their mission effectively. And so for me to pull resources from an already resource-deficient area of our Office of Veterans Services is problematic. So there's a challenge in that way, but it is an opportunity to help them grow in their area and then build the department by working with other secretaries to kind of figure out what right might look like for our department.
You mentioned the Office of Veterans Services. And until now, the state's veterans have been served by that office and the Commission on Veterans Affairs. They're going to be folded into this new department. What are some of the practical implications of moving in this direction? What can this department hopefully do that the office and the Commission weren't able to do or couldn't do?
I think that with the cabinet level secretary, mm-hmm. I can interact with the other cabinet levels, whether it's Health and Human Services, whether it's the State Housing Authority, whether it's Department of Corrections, Department of Labor. I can work with them to figure out where we have overlap in areas that support one another. Mm-hmm. And that takes that off of the office that's doing the busy work of meeting with veterans day to day. And then our commission, who's comprised of volunteers, it helps, like, they are my, they help me outreach to the community and keep that open. And so in the initial stages of this, I've been going out on the tour of Delaware, if you will, and taking our brand new executive director of the Office of Veteran Services with me so that we can go out and meet the veterans and talk in different places and different meet with different folks. And most of the ones that are really vocal, they definitely show up. So we get to hear from the vocal group and understand what's bugging them. Mm-hmm. And then start working on plans. And then as we do that, we also get to meet with some of the less vocal veterans. We'll reach out. And so we figure out where we need services, where there's gaps. We know, you know, the Office of Veteran Services know where some of the gaps are. But some of the gaps are really just communicating from Health and Human Services to us and really just educating the public, not just the veterans. But it is a lot like of education of veterans themselves. Of this is what's available to you. This is how you go about that process. If something isn't going the way they expected, so you know, this is true of anyone, not just veterans. But if you have a certain answer that you might not like, it doesn't change the fact that that's the answer. So then, if there is something that a policy that's out there that's not meeting the needs of the veterans, then we take note of it, and then I can take care of that. The Office of Veteran Services can continue their day-to-day work of meeting with and trying to help veterans with immediate issues. And I and the team that I will build can work on the policy, the legislation, and the things that are above them that they don't have the time to work with. But I can kind of focus on helping in those areas so that it makes the veterans and their families' lives easier, but also helps our team know where different resources are or if we can make changes in legislation.
So for you working at that higher level, being at the cabinet table, it is kind of a game changer in terms of what you think you can accomplish for the veterans, on some of the issues that they're talking about.
Absolutely.
So, one of the other things that this department will have oversight of is the two Veterans Memorial Cemeteries and the state-run Veterans Home. The home has seen issues with staffing. Is that among your top priorities?
It is. I have an office there, and so I'm getting to work with the team there. And so it isn't that they don't – the staffing issues at the home are not that – we have a good patient to staff ratio there. The issues are we're having to contract folks into the jobs because it's less attractive. The even with bonuses and different opportunities, the pay scale for a contract nurse, RN or LPN, for example, right, versus what our state pay is there. There's a balance. And so it can be hard, and it's challenging times right now for everyone.
Sure.
So people are looking for the higher paycheck. We're trying to convince them don't lose sight of a state job and the great benefits that come with it and the retirement pension plan that's built in that you might not have in this higher paying job. So that's also an education piece that we have to work through. So, but they, I'm working right with that team day to day and get to see what their struggles are, what their challenges are, and a lot of it's education so that people understand who's eligible,
right,
and how you fit into the piece there.
One of the things you were talking about earlier is just kind of general awareness for Delaware veterans of the benefits that they're entitled to: tax credits, discounted fees, licenses, educational opportunities. You talked about outreach. Are there some other specific ways you feel like you can get the message out to veterans about what they already have?
So some of its barriers, your veteran population has a tendency to think that they don't need or that maybe they don't deserve, or they feel like they're less deserving than someone else that has visible signs of being involved in the war. And so kind of getting people over that hurdle to help meet them where they're at, And that just meeting them where they're at mentally, where mm-hmm. they're at. And that's the job of our VSOs to help us with that. The other piece of that is how do we connect with them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're down in Sussex County where I live, you're very dispersed. And so we have to be creative in – I think we have, for the most part, reached out to our Vietnam veteran area. We still have a group of that population that's still hurt from the way they were treated
sure.
years ago. But generally speaking, I feel like we're overcoming that. But we still have some outreach for those types of folks to make sure that we help them over any continuing hurdles that are in place for them. For the folks that are global war on terror, so you know, after 9/11, that's just a younger population that's busy going through the meat grinder of day-to-day life, raising a family, working. And so how do we meet them to make sure that they're aware of the benefits that they might have been overlooking, and then get them connected to community? Because I feel like a big issue that we have is people feel disconnected. And so my big goal is how do we connect all these people? Because I think that's a huge piece to improving the mental well-being
sure.
of not just the veterans, but even their families. Because if a veteran's struggling and they're disconnected from a community where they feel understood and heard, then their family is also hurting. And so getting those connections and making those connections is going to be a huge, helpful thing for the veterans in our communities.
And you mentioned you've been out there already trying to meet veterans where they are. Have you heard any specific issues that have come up that you feel like, oh, okay, that's something that needs to be prioritized?
I think it's access, just access to resources and awareness. The most vocal veterans are the veterans that are getting are our older generation of veterans, and I think they feel like they're carrying the load on their own, and so they're wondering where folks of my age, my generation, or younger, where are we at? Because that's what I heard even before I came into the job. Like, they just feel like membership, and where are the folks? We know there's a lot of other veterans out there, and they're not part of our American Legion, VFW, DAV, you know, all the different wonderful organizations we have out there. They just want to know, where are they at? I was like, we have to bridge that gap.
And that's important for you in terms of outreach, right? If you can have them in those communities, it makes it a lot easier to reach them because they're in congregated spaces.
Yes.
I'm curious, you mentioned during your confirmation that one other thing you would do is like reach out to peers in other states to see what Delaware can learn from them. Have you had a chance to do that so far? And if you have, what have you learned?
So we have regional meetings. We have two meetings a year at this National Association of Veterans Organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's my peers at all the different state and territory levels. We have regional meetings, and we had one a couple weeks ago that the director, Tony Bordeaux, and I were able to be on. And so through there, we understand national level issues that are going on and how our peers are interacting. There's a new program afoot for VA, for community health care scheduling. And that is a thorn in every veteran's side that is involved. Like, I call and it rings and rings and rings, and different folks are frustrated at different levels. And it's not the actual care mm-hmm. necessarily that they're getting. It's getting it scheduled. And so there's a brand new program out that we wouldn't have known about had we not been a part of this national organization. I reach out and say, hey, I see you have some of these setups. How is that funded in your state? And so those are the ways that I'm trying to leverage those relationships.
That's already kind of an example of why having that kind of state level, cabinet level position really makes sense, because it puts you in those conversations that maybe we weren't in already.
Absolutely.
The law requires the department to be operational by July 1, 2030. Do you feel that can or will happen sooner?
I would imagine it will.
Mm-hmm.
And so, right now in the fiscally challenging times
right.
we're in nationally, like, so that's not the most open discussion, and that's not first and foremost on everyone's mind. But as I plan out even who my team is, I will be working with the Department of Human Resources, Secretary Gordon, mm-hmm. and talking about how does that look like. You know, I'll look at different positions and say, hey, I think I've talked to different cabinet level members. I'm going to need community outreach or legislative liaisons mm-hmm. on my team, because right now I'm kind of doing that myself. And so I will look out and we'll figure that out. And then there's budget lines that go with that. And so right now the Department of State is supporting and funding us for now. Mm-hmm. We've broken apart where we're handling the cemetery. We are overseeing like the cemetery budget and our office budget. And they are still taking the lead on the veterans' home. Mm-hmm. And but I'm down there learning that sure. process as we go through. So even when we go into next year's budget season, I'll do the military. We call it a right seat ride. I will sit with the Department of State's team as we're going through the budget for the veterans' home, so that I hear what the asks are and the questions are, and I'm involved in that, and I can take some of the. Like, I'm there every day working down there, or just about every day. I'm kind of all over the place right now. But I'm down there. So I talk to the veterans. I know this, like, I'm talking to the staff. And I can see operationally what's going on and understand what they're doing better than perhaps. I think the Department of State did a decent job of trying sure. to go down there.
During this transition time, do you feel like there are some things you will be able – to accomplish on some of the priority list type of things kind of concurrently with just getting this whole thing organized? Because it feels like that's what you're going to try to do, but that's definitely a heavy lift.
They like if I'm prioritizing, it's definitely the first priority is to go out and feel where the veterans feel left out, because some of the outreach – if people aren't coming into us, it's because they don't feel like they're heard. Mm-hmm. So I think that just the act of being yeah. out and present will bring some of the folks back in that might have felt like, oh, it's not worth it. Like, I'm not going to be able to do that. So I have to be first ready to support with my Office of Veterans Services, have the team in place that can support that influx of needs. I will help be a point when the legislator has questions, I find this even in some events that I'm doing like this, people don't distinguish the difference. So I'm very familiar with the Guard mm-hmm. And how it operates. My husband was, was the adjutant general, and I was the assistant adjutant general in another state. But I understand how those things work. But I think a lot of times folks don't understand that veterans' issues are separate from the operational, like day-to-day business of the active duty AGR or even the guardsmen, traditional guardsmen like I was. They're separate, and where some people see, oh, it involves a service member or it involves, and they will push the problem to, like they will push a concern, I shouldn't call it a problem, a concern to me that someone has, and I'll look at it and go, that's... I know where that goes.
Right.
But so I'm kind of dealing with that. There's sure. a lot of overlap, and people don't understand the separation of veteran services versus the actively yeah. serving.
So as we wrap up, is there a message you'd like to give Delaware veterans as we approach Veterans Day?
Veterans Day, and a big message for me, Veterans Day is one of the many days in the year where we as veterans and our families get to connect. And so I think of like my mother, whose husband was a Vietnam veteran, and two of her children were in the military and deployed, and her son-in-law deployed, and one of her grandchildren deployed. And so it's not just about veterans, it's about the families, the support systems of families. These are days where we get to kind of link up and recognize each other, honor the service of those that are, have gone before us. My best friend's father was a World War II veteran, and I know Veterans Day is special to her. Her son's now currently serving, and he's still serving, but he's also a veteran. And so these are important days out there to kind of connect with others. So I hope the veterans out there make an opportunity on Veterans Day at least, but at, you know, as many times during the year to reconnect because it makes a difference.
Thanks to Delaware's Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary, retired Brigadier General Karen Berry, for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We learn more about what a recent survey of first-day teachers tells us about how satisfied educators are with their jobs. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The state's largest teachers union, the Delaware State Education Association, recently released the results of its latest teacher satisfaction survey. That survey, conducted via email by Emma White Research, connected with 1,460 active DSEA members between July 11th and 18th to take their temperature on a variety of topics, including teacher pay and working conditions. The survey produced mixed results, and this week we sat down with DSEA President Stephanie Ingram to delve into those results and what they tell us about how teachers in the First State are feeling. Before we dig into the actual results, I'm curious why surveys like this are important. What does DSEA hope to draw from the information you get by doing surveys like this one?
Well, we have more than 14,000 members statewide over a variety of job classifications, and we're just looking to try to get the most information we can from that number of members. It's impossible for us to talk to every one of them, so surveys like this help us to kind of do a little snapshot of what our members are thinking and how they're feeling about the things that are important to them.
So let's talk about the top-line results, which show overall job satisfaction at 80%. That's up from 74% in 2024. 65% of educators now say they plan to stay in the profession for at least the next couple of years, compared to 62% in 2024. And your organization has suggested that part of these slight improvements in the numbers are thanks to Delaware's efforts to improve teacher pay. Is there a reason why you feel like that connection's part of what's driving this improved satisfaction from teachers?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the idea that if educators are being paid more, that they're more willing to stay in the jobs. Just like you said, it's a small piece to the puzzle. We're looking to see what educators need to improve job satisfaction, and this is what we know is one thing we can do to help our educators want to stay in the positions that they're in.
And part of what Delaware has done is given pay raises to teachers over the last couple of years. They've also made the commitment to get to a $60,000 starting salary for teachers by fiscal year 2028. Is there any concern on DSEA's part that the state's current financial situation, some of the issues that they're facing, both created by the federal government and some at the state level, could impact teacher pay negatively going forward and maybe slow progress to that starting salary goal?
That's a great question. We are slightly concerned about, you know, the outlook for the next few years, but we're hoping that legislators will keep their promises to educators and to students and to find the money to make sure that the pay increases are funded in the way that we expect them to be.
One of the other things is the difference between the state share of that pay and the local district share. The state share obviously has gone up over the last couple of years with those commitments from lawmakers, not seeing necessarily the same on the local district share level. Are there ways to address that, particularly in the wake of property reassessment? Because there's certainly perhaps less of a appetite for referendum. Are there other ways to try and attack the local share of teacher pay?
Well, I'm sure there are, and that's something that we're interested in having the conversations around. You know, you mentioned referendum reassessment. We just need to take a look at what locals are doing now to make up their 30% of the funding for our educators, and then to see what exactly can they do. I'm not exactly sure about, you know, the monies behind it and how they can maybe move monies around or how locals can get more revenue into the system. But it's something that we're looking to sit down and really talk about.
Is part of that conversation referendum reform? We've heard a lot about that maybe there's something just structurally wrong with the process itself. Is that something DSEA pays attention to and has some thoughts on?
We absolutely do. We think of the idea of referendum reform as something that we need to start to really think about in a different way, because we know that the process doesn't work in the way that it should. We are the only state that does referendums for capital and
the operating.
Operating.
Yep.
costs. So we need to think about what that looks like and how we can do that differently and what it looks like to not have to go to taxpayers repeatedly to ask them for more money to make sure that we're doing the improvements our students need and the improvements that our schools need to make sure that everyone's successful. So there's got to be a different way to do it. We just haven't struck the right balance yet.
So on the one side, we talked about teacher pay, and it seems like that's a positive thing that's heading in the right direction, trending in the right direction. Looking into the survey about working conditions, only 27% say they're satisfied with current conditions. That's a bit worse than 2024. Are the states and districts doing enough to address the working condition issues at this point?
A lot of things go into working conditions.
Right.
When you think about an educator working conditions, you're talking about the variety of educators, first of all. We represent most of the educators in a school building, and most of the educators are outside of the school building. So we're talking about bus drivers,
right.
Food service workers, nurses, counselors, custodians, constables. We're talking about educators in the classroom, educators who are specialists outside of the classroom. So all of those conditions could be different. So we could be talking about just the time it takes to create lesson plans and to grade the papers and to deliver the instruction, the time it takes on the back end to grade the papers and enter in the information that you are recording. We could be talking about nurses who are also, busy doing the things that they need to do to provide the services for their students and then put that information in the computer. Food service workers are doing different things to deliver what they need to do for students. So all of those things inside of the building are what we talk about as far as working conditions go, but also outside. How much time outside of the workday am I doing work that has to be done so that I can be prepared for the next day for the students? Analyzing my performance in the classroom, if I'm a classroom teacher like I am, I'm thinking about how I can deliver instruction better based on, results of an assessment or a summative or a formative assessment that I might have given my students. There's a lot of things that go into satisfactory working conditions. The conditions of the buildings themselves
mm-hmm.
are also working conditions.
Right.
Do my windows close? Is it drafty? Is the temperature proper for the students to be able to concentrate and to do what they need to do? So all of those things are encapsulated in what we're kind of calling working conditions. And so some of them are being addressed in the ways that we can, and some of them are things that are like constant nagging little things mm-hmm. that could be tweaked, just taking some things off our educators' plates. Do I have to be the one to take attendance? Is that someone else who could do that? Do I need to do little kind of the administrative tasks that maybe someone else could do that will free up some time to allow me to meet with my fellow educators and colleagues? There's a lot of things that we could be doing differently. I think we just need to kind of hone in on what it is and how we can change and improve working conditions for educators.
Is that why it's a tough number to move the needle on? Because it's a moving target with a lot of different targets. So that's a lot going on. The couple of moments there you spent describing all that, and that really just kind of is the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, absolutely. I haven't even, we didn't even delve to everything. There's a lot of moving parts when you're talking about working conditions. So, you might be focused on analyzing just responsibilities or even time concerns, but that doesn't talk about building conditions and issues like we talked about.
Technology.
It doesn't talk about student behavior concerns that we've been talking about for a couple years now either that all go into being satisfied with your job.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the student behavior piece. That's where I wanted to go next, because that's one specific area where teachers did seem to have some concerns, at least expressed in the survey. It found about 58% are at least somewhat more likely to leave education over student behavior concerns, about the same as 2024. You mentioned this has been something that's been talked about over the last couple of years. There was a student behavior and school climate task force that offered some recommendations about a year ago this time. Are you hopeful that there's some improvement on the way, that there's progress being made?
Yeah, so we're definitely hopeful. The conversation needs to continue. Again, we're just scratching the surface on what it is that our students need in the schools. We've been talking about mental health services for a while and knowing that, providing services to our students to make sure that they are comfortable with themselves and that they're healthy and happy and, that school is a safe place for all students is important. But then thinking about when it's not, or when a student is not at 100%,
mm-hmm.
what can we do to lessen the impact of that student's behavior on the others in the classroom? And just, again, working to try to make sure that we're helping to address the needs that the student might have. So it's hard because their behaviors manifest in a lot of different ways.
Right.
So I think for educators, when we're talking about student behaviors. We're just trying to lessen the impacts that some of those more wayward student behaviors might have on the class or the student themselves, you know, because it takes away from an instruction time mm-hmm. and the time that you're able to create and strengthen the relationships that you have with your students. Is kind of impacted as well because you're, you know, addressing the needs of the students as they occur. So I think if we continue to think about what mental wellness looks like for every student and for our educators as well, I think we'll be seeing, you know, a positive track to trying to lessen some of the behaviors that we're seeing in the classroom that distract from what we're doing.
Are there any kind of low-hanging fruit issues in that realm that might be, again, there's no quick fixes, but there's some things that could be done maybe more immediately to kind of, again, get the ball rolling.
Well, one of the things that we've been seeing in some nationwide reports and some things that have been happening in other states is kind of limiting the use of cell phones mm-hmm. or even banning cell phones, you know, bell to bell. So the students have to, you know, put their cell phones away so they're not distracted by all the things that your phone can do. And they're really focusing on what's happening in the classroom and it, interacting and socializing with the people in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So just kind of lessening the distractions, I think, is one way that we could start to address some of the issues that are happening.
I was going to say on that topic, I mean, there have been some efforts there. There have been pilot programs and things like that. Is perhaps the key maybe something that's just more consistent across districts that everybody feels like they're operating under the same structure with cell phones?
Yeah, I think if we could get the districts to kind of sit down and talk about what it looks like to be in agreement as far as cell phone policy so we could have a consistent, like you said, a consistent use or in this case, you know, non-use of cell phones during school time. And we could see, does it really make the difference that we know it does? Can we start there and just, you know, start with that one thing and then continue to build upon the difference that you'll see in the climate and the community and the schools? I think that would be a great start.
Some ideas educators in the survey support pursuing include supporting smaller class sizes. That was 97%, kind of an obvious one, right? Mm-hmm. Supporting additional instructional staff in high needs classrooms, 93%, and an increase in recess time and other play-based learning in K through 3 classes, 83%. Do you see a path forward to make any or all of these happen?
Yes, I definitely, you know, we did just talk about the cell phones, and that would be a great way to start, but having additional support in our schools would be great as well, because then we could use those resources to really address the student needs. And that's one thing that we could think about doing. How do we get more personnel in our schools to help to kind of alleviate some of the issues that we're seeing? And then the last one you talked about was play. And I would argue that play should be something that we really strive for, not just K to 3, but, you know, maybe even K to 8, because mm-hmm. everyone needs that unstructured time and the ability to use that time to learn how to socialize and to interact with other people and to just kind of, you know, take a break and relax too sometimes. I think play-based learning is important. That's how students best learn. You know, we think about how the brain is formed and play is how students learn. And so for us to be able to give that time to them to devote to the way that they actually truly learn best would be fabulous. And you would see a huge result if we were able to include play-based learning and instruction, and then more recess time would be great as well.
Is it fair to say that the smaller class sizes is probably the toughest one to get to?
Yeah, I would say that it would be. It's not insurmountable, but, you know, again, you would require more educators to be put into the classrooms, you know, so that you could have those smaller class sizes and you could address the student needs. So we would just be working, you know, in this time where we know that all states are facing an educator shortage, we would just need to make sure that we're attracting educators to Delaware and helping to keep them.
One of the things that was in the survey as well was a question about school district consolidation. There seemed to be some trepidation among those who responded to that. The Reading Consortium is working on that right now. Where does DSEA stand on consolidation and its potential impact on teachers?
Well, the survey results were based on a question that kind of mirrored what Maryland does, and they have districts based on the counties. So
right.
If we were thinking about having, you know, three districts because we have three counties in Delaware, what would that look like?
Mm-hmm.
How would we be able to distribute resources and educators? What would it look like to provide services for students based by county and not by district? And our members aren't really solidly behind the idea one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I think that there needs to be more conversation about what it looks like. And just making sure that the districts are resourced in the way that they need to be, staffed in the way that they need to be, funded equitably, and, you know, just to provide for stability for students if we were to go in that direction. There's a lot of concern around just the little puzzle pieces that you'd have to put together to make that work and to make it sustainable. So I think the conversation needs to be had about what that looks like, mm-hmm. if that's where we're looking to go. We have a lot of issues in consolidation that we'd have to address before we could get educator buy-in. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered, but I wouldn't say that we're not open to having those conversations.
But I think it feels like before any of that can happen, there's that one issue that's kind of looming over everything, which is the work to reinvent the education funding formula that's going on right now. I'm curious, where do you see that process intersecting with teachers and their needs and their concerns?
Well, again, I think the one thing that educators want as far as funding goes, we just need our funding to be predictable, and we need the funding to be stable, and we need it to be equitable. So mm-hmm. if we're able, again, to provide the resources that our students need, make sure we're meeting our educators' needs as well, I think the conversation just needs to be how can we best do all those things? You know, how can we hit all those targets to make sure that the funding system that we get is better than the one we have, because we know it's not working. Mm-hmm. But to address the concerns that we do have, making sure that it's equitable, meeting the needs of those students who might come from somewhat less resourced schools or disadvantaged circumstances, to make sure that those needs for those students are being met, making sure that the educators in those situations have the resources they need to meet those needs, and just making sure that our students are successful no matter where they are, no matter where they come from. I think those conversations are the ones that we're interested in having.
Is the hope that if the funding formula gets done well, that a lot of the other things we've been talking about can move forward under a more solid foundation?
I would say yes. So if we were able to get the funding situation to where we know it would work best for all students and all educators, I think that we could then start to put those other pieces in place.
So this survey is done about a year after the previous one was done. Mm-hmm. So I'll finish with a basic question. Are you more or less optimistic than you were a year ago based on what you see in this survey and what you're seeing on the ground every day?
I'm optimistic because I know that our educators are more satisfied, which is always where you want them to be. You know, so I'm optimistic that we're making the small changes that we need to. I'm optimistic that we're also looking down the road at larger changes and again, working to make sure that everyone in the system is having their needs met. I think that's where we need to be.
Thanks to Delaware State Education Association President Stephanie Ingram for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up this week's show next with Arts Playlist, where we preview the Delaware Art Museum's latest exhibition on the art of illustration. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A new exhibition at the Delaware Art Museum caps off the museum's year-long celebration of the art of illustration. Imprinted, Illustrating Race was co-curated by University of Delaware professor Robin Phillips Pendleton and opened at the Norman Rockwell Museum. Now that exhibition takes up residence in Wilmington through next spring. To learn more about the show and the intersection of popular illustration and identity, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny talked to Heather Campbell Coyle, curator of American art at the Delaware Art Museum, for this week's Arts Playlist.
To start with, tell me about this show and some of the works and some of the artists that are featured in it.
Absolutely. So Imprinted explores over 200 years of representations of race in American illustration. So by illustration, I mean work that was made largely for books and magazines, but also for advertising, trade cards, posters, you know, just popular culture items. It even has a cookie jar in it. And the exhibition is strongest in work from the mid-19th century to the present. So really, starting with the abolitionist movement, it has incredible cartoons by Thomas Nast, And illustrations for Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was such an important book in inspiring the abolitionist movement, and then heads into the early 20th century, looking at work by Norman Rockwell and J.C. Leyendecker, as well as work by Harlem Renaissance artists like Lois Mailou Jones and E. Sims Campbell. Moves into the civil rights movement, obviously a really important part of the show. We have some extraordinary examples from the Black Panther, as well as wonderful works by Emery Douglas, cartoons from the Black Press, which gives sort of biography and information about important figures in history whose stories weren't really being told in other spaces. And then finally, the last third of the show, a huge part of the show, really focuses on illustration from the 1970s through today, primarily by Black illustrators, illustrators of color. It has beautiful works from children's books, like works by Jerry Pinkney and Brian Pinkney. It has works by the co-curator, Robin Phillips Pendleton, and some classics by Charles Lilly, who did some incredible historical work, subject matter, and then works by Kadir Nelson, Tim O'Brien, and Rudy Gutierrez, who just all entered the Society of Illustrators Hall of Fame last month. So really important contemporary illustrators who are taking on subject matter and material around race.
Tell me about the co-curators of this exhibit.
Absolutely. So this exhibition was assembled by Robin Phillips Pendleton. She is a professor of visual communication at the University of Delaware. And Stephanie Plunkett, who is the curator at the Norman Rockwell Museum. They started putting this together. Well, Robin started the research really in about 2014. As a working illustrator and professor of visual communication, she was very aware that when she was growing up, she wasn't really seeing images in the popular press that looked like her as a Black woman. So that research really started there and spun out over several years. There was a big committee. I was on the committee for the exhibition. And then the exhibition came together, and now it opened there in 2022. It's here now, and then it will go to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis.
You mentioned sort of the time period beginning after the Civil War, and it feels to me like that was a particularly fertile period for publishing, especially with new magazines starting up, new technologies in printing allowing more books to be mass-produced. Was it a good time to be an illustrator, especially in that late 19th, early to mid 20th century period?
Absolutely. And that's the period actually I'm most familiar with, because here at the Delaware Art Museum, the focus of our collection is really 1870s to 1940s. So that was a period of extraordinary growth in the press and in the illustrated press as new technologies made it more affordable and more accessible to illustrate work first in black and white, and then increasingly, as you get into the early 20th century, in full color. So it's a really dynamic time. It's a time, in some ways, certainly in the 1870s and 1880s, before it's affordable to reproduce photographs. So really the main things you're looking at in publications are going to be illustrations. So it's a time also where children's books take off. There's more interest in illustrated children's books. The number of magazines, due to advertising revenues mostly, expands greatly as you have national corporations who want to reach national audiences. And magazines are the main way to do that until radio really becomes national.
I wonder, so many facets of American society were segregated. Was the world of publishing equally segregated?
Absolutely. The publishing industry always really reflects what's happening in the nation, and certainly when it comes to segregation. The vast majority of magazines were aimed at a white middle-class audience, or maybe a white upper-middle-class audience, but very few magazines, and really almost none until you get into the early 20th century. There's really only a couple, the growth of the Black press beginning at that point, where because there's not the stories being told, because there aren't outlets for Black writers and Black artists, the Black press develops and really comes into its own with The Crisis, which is the magazine of the NAACP. With Opportunity, with The Voice. There's this, a series of really important magazines that start to tell Black stories. And There's even newspapers that have national circulation, like the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier. These weren't just your local paper. These were weekly Black newspapers that went out much more broadly.
The exhibition has some work by a famous Delaware artist, Howard Pyle. Can you talk a little bit about his work that's on display?
Absolutely. So Pyle is active at the time when the press is definitely segregated. So the magazines that he's illustrating for most, Harper's Monthly, Scribner's, The Century, these magazines would have, in the course of a year, maybe 800 illustrations, and maybe 20 of them might represent African American or even inclusive of African subjects as well. So Pyle's working in a period where there aren't a lot of illustrations being made telling any Black stories. But Pyle grows up in what I would call an abolitionist context. He's here in the mid-Atlantic. He's 8 years old when the Civil War breaks out. And this is an area where there's a lot of discussion about this because it wasn't like foretold whether Delaware was kind of a border state, right? There was a lot of conversation about supporting the Union versus supporting the Confederacy. So I think he's raised very much aware of the issues around enslavement, of the Emancipation Proclamation, of all of that stuff, you know, kind of happening in his youth. So he sometimes includes African-American subjects when he's illustrating history. And that the illustration of American history is a huge part of Pyle's career. So most of the examples we have of Pyle illustrating Black people, enslaved people, or free African-Americans are in his history pictures. But he certainly understands that the history of enslavement is an important part of the history of the United States. Also that figures like Crispus Attucks, the first patriot to die in the Boston Massacre, who's of African and Wampanoag descendants, he understands that that is part of the American story. And it's included in his work.
One really familiar name that people can see in this show is Norman Rockwell. And I'm just curious how did he treat race and identity in his work? Because it feels to me like he's sort of the epitome of Mr. and Mrs. Middle Class America.
Sure. So, you know, Norman Rockwell, for most of us, is so deeply associated with the 1920s, 30s, 40s images in the Saturday Evening Post, particularly those covers of kind of, as you said, those kind of white American stories, right? And that was absolutely how the Saturday Evening Post was and what the audience was. They were looking for a white middle class audience. And while he's there at the Post, really the only way African Americans are featured in images is in positions of service, generally in positions of service to white people. So porters on trains, there's an image of a train waiter serving a young boy that supposedly is based on an experience he actually had where his son was trying to figure the tip and this waiter is like patiently waiting for him to do it. And that's typical of what he's doing in that period. But by the time you get into the 1950s and 1960s, Rockwell has realized that he wants to portray what he thinks is the most important thing going on in the world, which is the struggle for civil and human rights. And so he is turning his attention in new directions, and he has to find a new place to do that. And he goes and starts doing some work for Look magazine, which was largely a photojournalist magazine. But their primary focus was on current events. He stops working for the Post after 47 years and then begins to work for places that are going to, you know, put out the stories that he's interested in telling.
From talking about Norman Rockwell, I want to talk about the Norman Rockwell Museum because there's a partnership here. Tell me how the Delaware Art Museum is working with the Norman Rockwell Museum through this.
Sure. So for years, we have worked with the Rockwell because they are one of only a handful of institutions that really do a lot with American illustration, which is such an important part of what we do here because we were founded with the work of Howard Pyle. And this particular moment, we are kind of trading shows. So one of the first people I talked to about this project I was working on, Jazz Age Illustration, which opened here about this time last year, was Stephanie Plunkett, because I was, you know, just trying to talk this out with somebody else in illustration. And she told me about Imprinted. And then we both worked on these projects side by side. And eventually we realized we could trade exhibitions. So this fall, while Imprinted is here, Jazz Age Illustration is at the Norman Rockwell.
Finally, what do you hope people who see this show take away with them?
I think I want people to see the power of popular illustration and of popular imagery and of what is being put out in the world, and to think about that and how that influences the lives of actual people, the self-image of people, and just to really think critically about that history. One of the things that has struck me throughout working on the show is how recent so much of it is. Even painful, difficult things are, you know, not lots of generations away. They're really quite recent.
Thanks to Heather Campbell Coyle, curator of American art at the Delaware Art Museum, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. Imprinted, Illustrating Race, is on display at the Delaware Art Museum through March 1st, with various gallery talks scheduled as well. More information is available at delart.org. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for a weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny for helping make this week's show possible. For him and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.